Marshall Musa Muslim Abui, also known as Marshall Washington Cabinus. I am the great-grandson, the senior male descendant of the Honorable Booker T. Washington, and I am the host of this show tonight, Booker T. Washington Speaks. This is a discussion forum that we hope that you will enjoy. It's an open mic discussion. We only ask that you be courteous and observe the right of the person that is talking to finish making his or her statement before you chime in. And after counting to three, if nobody else has come online, please feel free to come online and make any comments that you would like to make. We only ask that you don't say anything that will get any of us in trouble with the FBI, because some people have some very controversial ideas about the government right now, but we don't want those to be voiced on the show. Other than that, please speak your mind and be courteous and feel free to make any comments that you would like, but enjoy yourself tonight. This is Marshall Washington Cabinus Abui, your host for this evening, and we look forward to having a very lively and informative and entertaining discussion.
God, who in Arabic is called Allah in the Quran, but we're talking about the same God that Abraham, Moses, Jesus, and all the prophets bowed down and prayed to, the Lord, creator of all of the universe. And we say, most gracious, most merciful Master of the Day of Judgment, it is you who we worship and it is you who we serve. Guide us on the straight path, the path of those upon those, a path of, upon those whom you have blessed with your favors, and not the path of those whom you are angry with or who go astray. We'd like to begin by letting our audience know about our book, our forthcoming special edition to a book which we published in November of last, of actually 2015, called Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution. And I just want to share some of the topics, some of the contents of the book. Chapter 1, the name of Chapter 1 is Miseducation, which, by the way, is what we will be talking about on our show, Booker T. Washington Speaks, on next Saturday at 9 o'clock, same call-in number, and we'll be talking about the miseducation of the Negro or African American. And Chapter 2 is Danger. Chapter 3 is The Transformation. And Chapter 4 is A Passion for Self-Help. Chapter 5 is Education for Living. And Chapter 6 is Living the Legacy. Chapter 7 is Identity. And Chapter 8 is Why a Black Revolution. Chapter 9 is A School for Leadership. Chapter 10 is Up from the Muck and Mud. Chapter 11 is Training Leaders Early. Chapter 12 is A Dilemma of Reformation. And Chapter 13 is From Dust to Industry. And Chapter 14 is A Revolutionized Community. Chapter 15 is The Education of a Slave. And Chapter 16 is The Strategic Black Revolution. And Chapter 17 is Reflections. Chapter 18 is Legacy. Chapter 19 is The Wisdom of Dignified Labor. And Chapter 20 is A New Emancipation. And the book is entitled Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution, written by myself, Marshall Washington Cabinus Abui. And the subtitle is A Message That Will Change America. I'd just like to read the preface to the book just to acquaint you who are listening with the theme of this book, or the basic purpose or spirit that motivated me to produce it. I have known since I was a child of about 10 years old that I was destined to write and publish a book. At that time, I had not the slightest inkling that it would be about my great-grandfather, the Honorable Dr. Booker T. Washington, one of the most influential educators of the 20th century. What I did know is that I derived a great deal of pleasure from writing and from making, quotation marks around the word making books on the blank pages of books that my mother had the Tuskegee Institute printing shop construct for me about my thoughts on childish subjects. At my small roll-top desk, which my mother had given to me as a Christmas present, I toiled away at my nascent craft. Eventually, I earned a Bachelor of Arts degree in English, specializing in creative writing and professional writing. Along the way, I learned to actually view myself as a professional writer. With the publication and marketing of Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution November 2015, my childhood ambition became a reality. This book is a first. To my knowledge, no scholar or writer has been able to see my great-grandfather the way that I do. My first residence was the home that Booker T. Washington had his carpentry students build for his son, whose name was Ernest Davidson Washington, and his new bride, whose name was Edith Meriwether Washington. My playground was the beautiful manicured lawn of the Tuskegee Institute campus. I learned at the age of 4 or 5 to love classical music by listening to the well-executed musical performances of Tuskegee's piano students as I played on the grass across the street from the Carnegie Music Hall, which had been originally donated as a library building by the steel magnate Andrew Carnegie. I developed my reading skills at the age of 5 by reading classical literature in the Tuskegee Institute Library children's room. But most importantly, I gazed at the sun-blackened, larger-than-life statue of my great-grandfather, lifting the symbolic veil of ignorance from a freed ex-slave African-American. And I learned to see him, that is Booker T. Washington, as the hope of our people. Yes, I see Booker T. Washington as being the hope of our people. His daughter-in-law, my maternal grandmother, Edith Meriwether Washington, used to say to me that he was 100 years ahead of his time. He was murdered, it has been alleged, in 1915. Finally, 100 years after his death, the wise African-Americans are beginning to appreciate the wisdom of this great leader who had a design to raise African Americans up from slavery to become the masters of America, or to share at least in the mastering of America. My journey through life during the last 70 years has brought me to the realization that I have a final duty to perform before I leave this world. That is to arouse in the masses a love for what Booker T. Washington, whose real name, according to scholarship that I have become acquainted with, was Abu Bakr Taliaferro. This was because of the fact, according to one scholar who researched his genealogy, that his mother came from the people of Nigeria, the Muslim people of Nigeria, and because of the tradition there, she named her son one of the popular names for boys, and that was Abu Bakr. The boys were names like Umar or Abu Bakr or Muhammad or Ali, and she chose to name her son Abu Bakr. And the slave master, hearing the name Abu Bakr, which the mother didn't actually say Abu Bakr because it was traditional not to call the boys by the full name Abu Bakr, because Abu means father. So she just used the word Bakr. And the slave master heard it as Booker. But Booker T. Washington's son was actually named Bakr Washington, and later it was changed to Booker T. Washington II. So the Bakr came from Abu Bakr, and Booker T. Washington's mother informed him as he got older, even after he had started school, that his name was also Taliaferro. He was known as Washington because he went to school only knowing his name to be Booker, which is what the slave master had called him, but his mother called him Bakr. And he told the teacher his name was Booker, and he needed to have a second name because that was the custom to have two names, a first and second or last name. So he, out of his imagination, picked the name Washington to be his last name, and that's where the Booker Washington came from, and the T came from Taliaferro, which is the name his mother had also given him. But he offered our people as a vision of the future, or for the future, freedom, justice, and equality in a nation within a nation, here within the pluralistic fabric of the United States of America. I admit that this book is provocative. In fact, it may be painful to digest. But speaking on the subject of racial injustice, Booker T. Washington was no coward, nor was he, as is popularly broadcast, a segregation accommodationist. He clearly recognized the invariable law of divine justice and divine retribution. He went on to protest white injustice in the public press, writing that the difference in the color of the skin is a matter for which nature is responsible. No race can wrong another race simply because it has the power to do so without being permanently injured in morals and its ideas of justice. The Negro, meaning the African American, since we have chosen that to be called by today, but the Negro can endure the temporary inconvenience, but the injury to the white man is permanent. It is the one who inflicts wrong that is hurt, rather than the one on whom wrong is inflicted. It is for the white man to save himself from this degradation that I plead. This is Booker T. Washington still speaking. Let us hope that the wave of industrial feeling now extending over the country may find its culmination in the unmistakable and solid foundation of a magnificent people, and crystallize a race in conformity with the highest standard reached by man in the present age. And this is the preface to the book. I'll just share some more of the book for my audience, just as something to whet your appetite for the book. The book can be purchased by sending a text message to me at the area code 706, the number 399-5006, and in the text message put Booker T. Washington, or BTW, it's shorter to just put BTW, book order, BTW book order, and put your full name, and I will get back to you and let you know how to actually complete the order, the payment arrangements for completing the order for the book. But I'll begin to share some of the book with you as a preview. The book, as I said, is entitled Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution, A Message That Will Change America. I will stop right now and ask my caller with the last four digits of the phone number, 1052, if you are still online, if you still are able to hear me. Again, I'm reaching out to the caller who is in the 706 Grovetown, Georgia area with the last four digits, 1052. Are you still online and can you still hear me?
I am still online and I can still hear you.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. So I'll go ahead and continue. The first page of the book is entitled, or actually the first page of the main content of the book is entitled Booker T. Washington, a name that evokes mixed feelings. Almost all of the white people with whom I have spoken in my lifetime praise the name of Booker T. Washington. They sincerely believe that my great-grandfather, Booker T. Washington, was the greatest African-American that ever lived. On the other hand, most Negroes or Americans of African slave ancestry either do not know who Booker T. Washington was or do not think very highly of him. I have found that there are graduates of Tuskegee University, the school that he founded, that do not even have any idea about the foundation of character building and intellectual, moral, economic, and social development upon which their illustrious alma mater was built over 134 years ago. And sadly, some of those that do know something about Booker T. Washington are ashamed that he was the founder of the school that gave them their college and often graduate education. Why is this? And what, if anything, is Booker T. Washington's relationship to the Black Revolution? I, your host and the author of this book, am a product of the Black Revolution. I was born in 1943. And I attended Tuskegee Institute, which is now named Tuskegee University, during the beginning of the Black Revolution. I transferred from Tuskegee to the University of California at Berkeley in my junior year. And I was on that campus at the height of the Black Revolution. It was on the campus of the Tuskegee University, 3 weeks before his brutal assassination in New York, that I encountered a prominent leader of the Black Revolution, Malcolm X. It was his declaration of war against white supremacy, freedom by any means necessary, the ballot or the bullet, that ignited the spark that lit the fire of Black rebellion and pushed the long smoldering Black resistance to white oppression into a full-scale revolution. When I left Tuskegee during the summer of 1966, the embers of revolution there had already begun to glow. A student revolutionary, a worker for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, who was attending Tuskegee, had been murdered in cold blood in front of a busload of Tuskegee students earlier in the year, in January. He was one of my closest childhood friends. His name was Sammy Young Jr. Armed with a double-barrel shotgun, I helped to bury him. The eminent African-American historian and journalist, Lerone Bennett Jr., noted that revolutions do not spring full-blown from the head of Zeus or Martin Luther King Jr., or, may I add, Booker T. Washington. He observed that revolutions are the product of a discontented spirit that builds up over a period of time, and accumulates and strains against the dam of social habit. The dam against which Negro, or African American, as we say now, discontent is focused. The dam against which Negro discontent is focused, using Mr. Bennett's words, is white power. And any realistic analysis of the Negro rebellion must begin with the Negro's situation, a situation defined by power or the lack of it. In order to fully and accurately appreciate the relationship of my great-grandfather to the Black Revolution, especially as seen by Lerone Bennett in 1965, a century after the legal end of African-American chattel slavery, one must understand that horrific condition. It was the legal and social condition that characterized Booker T. Washington's earliest years and marked him for life, as an ex-slave. Slave, S-L-A-V-E, what does it mean? What are the short-term and long-term effects of the condition of chattel slavery? According to Professor Thad W. Tate, during the last quarter of the 17th century, the status of the Negro in the eyes of the law began to change once more. His personal rights, and this includes his and her, personal rights were reduced to a minimum, and he and she were both left as true chattel slaves. As early as 1669, the status of the enslaved African in America had ceased to be that of a man or a woman and had become merely that of a species of property. By the first quarter of the 18th century, the early 1700s, the dehumanization of the enslaved Negroes was nearly complete. Professor Edwin Embry, in a book called Brown Americans, written in the early part of the 20th century, related that Henry Barry, a member of the Virginia government, speaking in the Virginia House of Delegates, and keep in mind that slavery was first introduced by the English people into America in the state of, or colony of, Virginia. And so Henry Barry, speaking in the Virginia House of Delegates, the governing body of Virginia, in 1832, described the situation concerning Black people as it existed in many parts of the South at this time. He said, "We have, as far as possible, closed every avenue by which light may enter the slaves' minds, and if we could extinguish their capacity to see the light, if we could extinguish their capacity, their ability to see the light, meaning to have any type of intelligence, our work would be complete, and they would then be on the level with the beasts, the animals of the field, the workhorses and the cows and the donkeys and the mules, and then we would be safe. I'm not certain," he said, "that we would not do it if we could find the process, and that on the plea of necessity. We would say it was necessary for our own safety and survival to do this terrible deed of trying to extinguish the intellect of these Black people." And Edward Embry further noted that the situation did not improve for Negroes with time, did not improve as time, as 250 years dragged by, but the years dragged on with slaves and even free Negroes, increasingly denied instruction, even the most rudimentary education in the South, and meeting with neglect and intolerance in the North, and that emancipation of all the 4 million slaves and 500,000 free Negroes in the South, even only 5% could even read simple sentences or write their names. Booker T. Washington, who lived from 1856 until 1915, was born into this milieu of intellectual repression, and this experience at a very tender age began to breathe the fire of revolution into his soul. Not a revolution of the careless and suicidal kind espoused by many black groups during the 1960s, but a revolution of the spirit and of the morals and of the mental habits of the masses of Negroes that had been reduced to mere property of ruthless slave masters for over 2.5 dark and desolate centuries, on the shores and on the plantations and on the bayous of Southern America. Enough from slavery. His book, his autobiography, Booker T. Washington recalled, I had no schooling whatever while I was a slave, though I remember on several occasions I went as far as the schoolhouse door with one of my young mistresses to carry her books. And one can imagine this mistress, whose name was Miss Laura Burroughs, by the way, one can imagine her looking at her young Negro helper, who longed to go into the classroom and learn. But she said, if you want to imagine it, no, Booker, I can't let you go inside. Learning is not for niggers. A crushing thing to tell a young child with a bright mind that wants to learn. I can't let you go inside. Learning is not for niggers. The picture of several dozen little white boys and girls in a schoolroom, says Booker T. Washington, engaged in study, made a deep impression upon me, and I had the feeling that to get into a schoolhouse and study in this way would be about the same as getting into paradise. I had the feeling that to get into a schoolhouse and study the way that he saw these little white boys and girls engaged in study would be about the same for him as getting into paradise. Well, decades later, when the masses of African Americans were permitted and even encouraged to become educated, Dr. Washington, in The Future of the American Negro, another book which he published that he wrote, he promoted the idea that we have spent much time in the South in educating men and women, in letters alone, meaning the literary arts, reading and writing and arithmetic and the study of the classics, etc. And now we must turn our attention more than ever to educating them to supply their wants and needs. Indeed, this alone was a revolutionary concept because for nearly three centuries, the African Americans in the South had been forced to be completely dependent upon their slave masters and their slave masters' children to supply all of their wants and needs. Black revolutionary author Professor Larry Neal noted that the Black Power movement, a central that he expect to be the Black revolutionary, the God had sent them. Little did he expect to be the Black revolutionary that God has sent them to completely change their lives. Reflecting on his life's work in his book, Up From Slavery, Booker T. Washington very soberly and candidly confesses, quote, what I saw during my month of travel and investigation upon his arrival in Tuskegee, Alabama, left me with a very heavy heart. The work to be done in order to lift these people up seemed almost beyond accomplishing. Of one thing, I felt more strongly convinced than ever after spending this month in seeing the actual life of the colored people, and that was that in order to lift them up, something must be done more than merely to imitate New England education as it then existed, unquote. It is interesting to note at this point that here is a young man quite new to the dangers inherent in being a Black man in the hostile Deep South, who has one single focus in his mind, and that is to revolutionize and to change completely the impoverished and degraded lives of his fellow African Americans. Unlike later Black revolutionaries who sought to bring about these changes through political agitation or even threats of mob violence, as in the Watts riots that occurred 50 years after his death in 1965, Booker T. Washington was determined to use industriousness, education, and community development or nation building as a vehicle to lift the ex-slaves up as human beings and citizens of the United States of America. As stated, however, the type of education that he proposed was not the kind that was used to educate the already settled European Americans. Dr. Washington knew that teaching sharecroppers and tenant farmers how to read and write Greek and Latin or recite the romantic poetry of Wordsworth or Keats or Byron and Shelley was not the most advantageous road to economic and cultural advancement for the newly emancipated slaves. Another Black revolutionary, Professor W.E.B. Du Bois, a product of a New England Harvard education, opposed Booker T. Washington's method of uplifting the recently emancipated African Americans who lived in the Deep South. Although he had lived in urban Nashville, Tennessee, and Atlanta, Georgia, Dr. Du Bois's appreciation for the day-to-day struggles of Black and brown people lacked the depth of understanding that growing up on a Virginia slave plantation had given Booker T. Washington early in his life. He lacked the appreciation and the understanding that growing up on a Virginia slave plantation had given Booker T. Washington early in his life. Dr. Du Bois admitted that the prudent method of bringing about the cooperation of the European Americans in the uplifting of African Americans, the prudent method was to weld the former slaves to the future industries of the South. Although he praised the accomplishments of the common schools and the trade schools, such as the Tuskegee Institute, headed by Booker T. Washington, Professor Du Bois believed that it was the classical college education that would be the best vehicle to advance the masses of African Americans through the agency of the Talented Tenth, which was a few specially, or were a few specially selected college-trained African Americans, which he dubbed the Talented Tenth. Booker T. Du Bois's thinking was that within the minds of African Americans, there must come a loftier respect for the human soul that seeks to know itself and the world around it, and that seeks a freedom for self-expression and self-development. In achieving this ambitious goal of lifting up our people intellectually and culturally, W.E.B. Du Bois called upon classical intellectuals such as Shakespeare, Balzac, Dumas, Aristotle, and Aurelius as beacons for African American enlightenment. I'll stop the reading right now. See, we've had several or a couple of others come online, and I just want to introduce again our topic for this evening. We don't have but about 20 minutes left. Our topic for this evening is, how can we improve African American education? And I just want to provide a segue into that discussion. I was spending the earlier part of the hour previewing my new book, Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution, the special edition, which is in publication at this time and should be available for purchase in about 1 month. But it was originally published in November of 2015 and is now being revised. But I just want to share something from Professor John Harris that was written a number of years ago, but it's still relevant. Dr. Harris says, concerning education as it has proceeded since integration occurred back in the 50s, which actually didn't really take off until the late 60s and early 70s, even though the law was changed so that it could be accomplished in the late 50s. But the Supreme Court said that the states could proceed basically as slow as they wanted to go. But Dr. Harris said it was the black masses who first perceived that integration actually increases the white community's control over the black one by destroying black institutions, absorbing black leadership, and making its interests coincide with those of the white community. The international brain drain has its counterpart in the black community, which is constantly being denuded of its best trained people and many of its national leaders. Black institutions of all sorts, colleges, newspapers, banks, and even community organizations are all losing their better people to the newly available openings of white establishments. This lowers the quality of the Negro organizations, and in some cases causes their demise, and or increases their dependence on whites for survival. Such injurious, if unintended, side effects of integration have been felt in almost every layer of the black community. I'm going to go ahead now, and the mic is open at this time for our visitors. And if any one of you would like to take up that particular thought, that integration has actually been a disservice in many ways in the schools towards our children's development and in producing leaders for our community, you may go right ahead. First one that speaks will have the floor for the time that you need, and then we'll go ahead and share it with the next person.
Okay. Good evening. Can you hear me?
I can hear you fine. Can you hear me?
Okay, yes. Okay. My name is Raina Hamid. I'm in Augusta, Georgia. And I'm sorry to get on so late. I was trying to find the number. I just found it. You said your topic was, how can we improve African American education?
Yes, that's the topic for this evening.
Okay. We had a discussion last night, and I couldn't get back on for whatever you couldn't hear me, but we're dealing with the oligarchy, which is not even an oligarchy anymore. It's a plutocracy now. These people have been playing their little games with not only African Americans, but just poor people in general, by dividing and conquering us, using inventing race. Race is something that they use to make white people feel that they were superior to anybody that wasn't white. And by virtue of their skin color, they manipulate poor whites. And same thing just happened with the Donald Trump election. There's still the oligarchy and the plutocracy. They manipulate the poor whites into believing that any kind of gains that black people have made was because of it came at a cost, was at their expense. And now they're moving it up to another phase. They're going to use the immigrants now are going to be the immigrants and the blacks and the Muslims. So they're just playing games. Nothing has changed in this country where I can see since the 1600s, 1700s. Nothing has changed. So as far as educating our children, we first have to get some kind of economic risks going. We have to make progress in our community economically in order to, we have to get our people to understand that, okay, we just had a black president, but still, what happened? We're still in the same place. We have no roots. Martin Luther King's sculpture up there has no feet. No back either, I don't think. All over this planet, we have black people in the same condition. We have no convention centers. We can't compare to any other ethnic groups as far as making progress in our community. There's so much. It's like Jomo Kenyatta said, when the missionaries came to Africa, they came with the Bible. They taught them how to pray with their eyes closed. And when they opened their eyes, the missionaries had the land, and they had the Bible. And I don't see where anything has changed. And until we get some kind of economic footing so that we can have a civilized, intelligent, thriving, and productive community, I don't see where we're going to be able to move forward in terms of educating our people, because they have us in a catch-22. If you teach in a school system, you know that the parents have to help their children at home. If the parents don't help the children at home, then how are the children going to learn when they come to school? The teacher can't teach all social skills, academics, and whatever. It's not going to work. So people are overwhelmed in the school system right now. It's like the art of war is going on. You're trying to avoid conflict, and avoiding a conflict is costly because the winner of the comparison is always going to, you're going to get certain rewards, and competition is going to always be a comparison, and both are inevitable. And a comparison must be made before the choices can be made. And so you got parents at home trying to go to work, trying to take care of the kids. They can't come to the after-school program to help their kids. The kids can't come to the after-school program. I mean, it's just crazy. Until we get this economic, community economic thing set up and work together and struggle to make the sacrifice, like other people come to this country, and they're not trying to get into the White House, but they, what they are doing is they're making themselves a part of that tax base, the people who are being taxed, so that they can have a voice by, I don't know, my thing is, I see that we have to make progress as a community economically before we can move forward.
Well, thank you. I hope that this will lead
into an even more in-depth discussion about how we can change our economic situation. The mic is still open, and we invite anyone else who would like to. We have about 11 minutes left. We would like to make comments to go right ahead and take advantage of this time we have remaining.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead, please.
Oh, hi. This is Paulette Horton from Mobile, Alabama. How you doing?
Oh, just fine, Paulette. Good to hear from you.
Good. Okay. My thing is, you know, Booker T. Washington said we should always start from the bottom and work our way up. And in order to understand what we could do for education, you have to first appreciate where you live. Many people are not comfortable, you know, with where they live. I went into a neighborhood once. There was trash blowing everywhere, chicken bones, and you know, when you trash your neighborhood and you see trash on the campus, that shows that you don't appreciate where you are. And I think that in order to appreciate education, you got to appreciate your living situation, and you got to take pride in your community, and just take a stand in what you believe is comfortable for you. Because one thing, Booker T. Washington, they hated to see him coming back from his travels, because he always inspected everything. He inspected the campus. He inspected the furniture. He inspected everything to make sure everything is kept up. And in our neighborhoods, we should not have trash blowing everywhere, people cussing in front of your elders. It's those little things that you have to work on, because that is part of education. When you learn to respect yourself, you learn to respect. If you can respect yourself, you can respect your elders. And I just believe that, and that goes to, if you can respect yourself, you can respect the teachers that's before you trying to teach you. So we got to begin on a smaller level and work our way up. And that's what I believe. Until for you to grow, you have to understand the little things first. You can't have the big thing until you can fix the little things. Can I ask you?
Marshall Washington, Cabinet Abui, your host moderator for this evening, and we want to thank you for joining us this evening. We hope you have enjoyed our show, and we ask you to please come on and rejoin us on Saturday evening, this coming Saturday evening, for another exciting and informative discussion on Booker T. Washington Speaks. Until then, may God bless you and have a good night. Thank you. Muslim Abui, also known as Marshall Washington Cavinus. I am the great-grandson, the senior male descendant of the Honorable Booker T. Washington, and I am the host of this show tonight, Booker T. Washington Speaks. This is a discussion forum that we hope that you will enjoy, It's an open mic discussion. We only ask that you be courteous and observe the right of the person that is talking to finish making his or her statement before you chime in. And after counting to three, if nobody else has come online, please feel free to come online and make any comments that you would like to make. We only ask that you don't say anything that will get any of us in trouble with the FBI, because some people have some very controversial ideas about the government right now, but we don't want those to be voiced on the show. Other than that, please speak your mind and be courteous and feel free to make any comments that you would like, but enjoy yourself tonight. This is Marshall Washington Cabinets Abui, your host for this evening, and we look forward to having a very lively and informative and entertaining discussion.
God, who in Arabic is called Allah in the Quran, but we're talking about the same God that Abraham, Moses, Jesus, and all the prophets bowed down and prayed to, the Lord, creator of all of the universe. And we say, most gracious, most merciful Master of the Day of Judgment, it is you who we worship and it is you who we serve. Guide us on the straight path, the path of those upon those, the path of, upon those whom you have blessed with your favors, and not the path of those whom you are angry with or who go astray. We'd like to begin by letting our audience know about our book, our forthcoming special edition to a book which we published in November of last, of actually 2015, called Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution. And I just want to share some of the topics, some of the contents of the book. Chapter 1, the name of Chapter 1 is Miseducation, which, by the way, is what we will be talking about on our show, Booker T. Washington Speaks, on next Saturday at 9 o'clock, same call-in number, and we'll be talking about the miseducation of the Negro or African American. And Chapter 2 is Danger. Chapter 3 is The Transformation. And Chapter 4 is A Passion for Self-Help. Chapter 5 is Education for Living. And Chapter 6 is Living the Legacy. Chapter 7 is Identity. And Chapter 8 is Why a Black Revolution. Chapter 9 is A School for Leadership. Chapter 10 is Up from the Muck and Mud. Chapter 11 is Training Leaders Early. Chapter 12 is A Dilemma of Reformation. And Chapter 13 is From Dust to Industry. And Chapter 14 is A Revolutionized Community. Chapter 15 is The Education of a Slave. And Chapter 16 is The Strategic Black Revolution. And Chapter 17 is Reflections. Chapter 18 is Legacy. Chapter 19 is The Wisdom of Dignified Labor. And Chapter 20 is A New Emancipation. And the book is entitled Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution, written by myself, Marshall Washington Cabinets Abui. And the subtitle is A Message That Will Change America. I'd just like to read the preface to the book just to acquaint you who are listening with the theme of this book, or the basic purpose or spirit that motivated me to produce it. I have known since I was a child of about 10 years old that I was destined to write and publish a book. At that time, I had not the slightest inkling that it would be about my great-grandfather, the Honorable Dr. Booker T. Washington, one of the most influential educators of the 20th century. What I did know is that I derived a great deal of pleasure from writing and from making, quotation marks around the word making, making books on the blank pages of books that my mother had the Tuskegee Institute printing shop construct for me about my thoughts on childish subjects. At my small roll-top desk, which my mother had given to me as a Christmas present, I toiled away at my nascent craft. Eventually, I earned a Bachelor of Arts degree in English, specializing in creative writing and professional writing. Along the way, I learned to actually view myself as a professional writer. With the publication and marketing of Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution November 2015, my childhood ambition became a reality. This book is a first. To my knowledge, no scholar or writer has been able to see my great-grandfather the way that I do. My first residence was the home that Booker T. Washington had his carpentry students built for his son, whose name was Ernest Davidson Washington, and his new bride, whose name was Edith Meriwether Washington. My playground was the beautiful manicured lawn of the Tuskegee Institute campus. I learned at the age of 4 or 5 to love classical music by listening to the well-executed musical performances of Tuskegee's piano students as I played on the grass across the street from the Carnegie Music Hall, which had been originally donated as a library building by the steel magnate Andrew Carnegie. I developed my reading skills at the age of 5 by reading classical literature in the Tuskegee Institute Library children's room. But most importantly, I gazed at the sun-blackened, larger-than-life statue of my great-grandfather, lifting the symbolic veil of ignorance from a freed ex-slave African-American. And I learned to see him, that is Booker T. Washington, as the hope of our people. Yes, I see Booker T. Washington as being the hope of our people. His daughter-in-law, my maternal grandmother, Edith Meriwether Washington, used to say to me that he was 100 years ahead of his time. He was murdered, it has been alleged, in 1915. Finally, 100 years after his death, the wise African-Americans are beginning to appreciate The wise African Americans are beginning to appreciate the wisdom of this great leader who had a design to raise African Americans up from slavery to become the masters of America, or to share at least in the mastering of America. My journey through life during the last 70 years has brought me to the realization that I have a final duty to perform before I leave this world. That is to arouse in the masses a love for what Booker T. Washington, whose real name, according to scholarship that I have become acquainted with, was Abu Bakr Taliaferro. This was because of the fact, according to one scholar who researched his genealogy, that his mother came from the people of Nigeria, the Muslim people of Nigeria, and because of the tradition there, she named her son one of the popular names for boys, and that was Abu Bakr. The boys were named names like Omar or Abu Bakr or Muhammad or Ali, and she chose to name her son Abu Bakr, And the slave master, hearing the name Abu Bakr, which the mother didn't actually say Abu Bakr because it was traditional not to call the boys by the full name Abu Bakr, because Abu means father. So she just used the word Bakr. And the slave master heard it as Booker. But Booker T. Washington's son was actually named Bakr Washington, and later it was changed to Booker T. Washington II. So the Bakr came from Abu Bakr, and Booker T. Washington's mother informed him as he got older, even after he had started school, that his name was also Taliaferro. He was known as Washington because he went to school only knowing his name to be Booker, which is what the slave master had called him, but his mother called him Bakr. And he told the teacher his name was Booker, and he needed to have a second name because that was the custom to have two names, a first and second or last name. So he, out of his imagination, picked the name Washington to be his last name, and that's where the Booker Washington came from, and the T came from Taliaferro, which is the name his mother had also given him. But he offered our people as a vision of the future, or for the future, freedom, justice, and equality in a nation within a nation, here within the pluralistic fabric of the United States of America. I admit that this book is provocative. In fact, it may be painful to digest. But speaking on the subject of racial injustice, Booker T. Washington was no coward, nor was he, as is popularly broadcast, a segregation accommodationalist. He clearly recognized the invariable law of divine justice and divine retribution. He went on to protest white injustice in the public press, writing that the difference in the color of the skin is a matter for which nature is responsible. No race can wrong another race simply because it has the power to do so without being permanently injured in morals and its ideas of justice. The Negro, meaning the African American, since we have chosen that to be called by today, but the Negro can endure the temporary inconvenience, but the injury to the white man is permanent. It is the one who inflicts wrong that is hurt, rather than the one on whom wrong is inflicted. It is for the white man to save himself from this degradation that I plead. This is Booker T. Washington still speaking. Let us hope that the wave of industrial feeling now extending over the country may find its culmination in the unmistakable and solid foundation of a magnificent people, and crystallize a race in conformity with the highest standard reached by man in the present age. And this is the preface to the book. I'll just share some more of the book for my audience, just as something to whet your appetite for the book. The book can be purchased by sending a text message to me at the area code 706, the number 399-5006, and in the text message put Booker T. Washington, or BTW, it's shorter to just put BTW, book order, BTW book order, and put your full name, and I will get back to you and let you know how to actually complete the order, the payment arrangements for completing the order for the book. But I'll begin to share some of the book with you as a preview. The book, as I said, is entitled Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution, A Message That Will Change America. I will stop right now and ask my caller with the last four digits of the phone number 10:52 if you are still online, if you still are able to hear me. Again, I'm reaching out to the caller who is in the 706 Grovetown, Georgia area with the last four digits, 10:52. Are you still online and can you still hear me?
I am still online and I can still hear you.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. So I'll go ahead and continue. The first page of the book is entitled, or actually the first page of the main content of the book is entitled Booker T. Washington, a name that evokes mixed feelings. Almost all of the white people with whom I have spoken in my lifetime praise the name of Booker T. Washington. They sincerely believe that my great-grandfather, Booker T. Washington, was the greatest African American that ever lived. On the other hand, most Negroes or Americans of African slave ancestry either do not know who Booker T. Washington was or do not think very highly of him. I have found that there are graduates of Tuskegee University, the school that he founded, that do not even have any idea about the foundation of character building and intellectual, moral, economic, and social development upon which their illustrious alma mater was built over 134 years ago. And sadly, some of those that do know something about Booker T. Washington are ashamed that he was the founder of the school that gave them their college and often graduate education. Why is this? And what, if anything, is Booker T. Washington's relationship to the Black Revolution? I, your host and the author of this book, am a product of the Black Revolution. I was born in 1943. And I attended Tuskegee Institute, which is now named Tuskegee University, during the beginning of the Black Revolution. I transferred from Tuskegee to the University of California at Berkeley in my junior year. And I was on that campus at the height of the Black Revolution. It was on the campus of the Tuskegee University, 3 weeks before his brutal assassination in New York, that I encountered a prominent leader of the Black Revolution, Malcolm X. It was his declaration of war against white supremacy, freedom by any means necessary, the ballot or the bullet, that ignited the spark that lit the fire of Black rebellion and pushed the long smoldering Black resistance to white oppression into a full-scale revolution. When I left Tuskegee during the summer of 1966, the embers of revolution there had already begun to glow. A student revolutionary, a worker for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, who was attending Tuskegee, had been murdered in cold blood in front of a busload of Tuskegee students earlier in the year, in January. He was one of my closest childhood friends. His name was Sammy Young Jr. Armed with a double-barrel shotgun, I helped to bury him. The eminent African-American historian and journalist, Lerone Bennett Jr., noted that revolutions do not spring full-blown from the head of Zeus or Martin Luther King Jr., or, may I add, Booker T. Washington. He observed that revolutions are the product of a discontent spirit that builds up over a period of time, and accumulates and strains against the dam of social habit. The dam against which Negro or African American, as we say now, discontent is focused, using Mr. Bennett's words, is white power. And any realistic analysis of the Negro rebellion must begin with the Negro's situation, a situation defined by power or the lack of it. In order to fully and accurately appreciate the relationship of my great-grandfather to the Black Revolution, especially as seen by Lerone Bennett in 1965, a century after the legal end of African American chattel slavery, one must understand that horrific condition. It was the legal and social condition that characterized Booker T. Washington's earliest years and marked him for life as an ex-slave. Slave, S-L-A-V-E, what does it mean? What are the short-term and long-term effects of the condition of chattel slavery? According to Professor Thad W. Tate, during the last quarter of the 17th century, the status of the Negro in the eyes of the law began to change once more. His personal rights, and this includes his and her, personal rights were reduced to a minimum, and he and she were both left as true chattel slaves. As early as 1669, the status of the enslaved African in America had ceased to be that of a man or a woman and had become merely that of a species of property. By the first quarter of the 18th century, the early 1700s, the dehumanization of the enslaved Negroes was nearly complete. Professor Edwin Embry, in a book called Brown Americans, written in the early part of the 20th century, related that Henry Berry, a member of the Virginia government, speaking in the Virginia House of Delegates, and keep in mind that slavery was first introduced by the English people into America in the state of, or colony of, Virginia. And so Henry Berry, speaking in the Virginia House of Delegates, the governing body of Virginia, in 1832, described the situation concerning Black people as it existed in many parts of the South at this time. He said, "We have, as far as possible, closed every avenue by which light may enter the slaves' minds, and if we could extinguish their capacity to see the light, if we could extinguish their capacity, their ability to see the light, meaning to have any type of intelligence, our work would be complete, and they would then be on the level with the beasts, the animals of the field, the workhorses and the cows and the donkeys and the mules, and then we would be safe. I'm not certain," he said, "that we would not do it if we could find the process, and that on the plea of necessity. We would say it was necessary for our own safety and survival to do this terrible deed of trying to extinguish the intellect of these Black people." And Edward Embry further noted that the situation did not improve for Negroes with time, did not improve as time, as 250 years dragged by, but the years dragged on with slaves and even free Negroes. increasingly denied instruction, even the most rudimentary education in the South, and meeting with neglect and intolerance in the North, and that emancipation of all the 4 million slaves and 500,000 free Negroes in the South, even only 5% could even read simple sentences or write their names. Booker T. Washington, who lived from 1856 until 1915, was born into this milieu of intellectual repression. And this experience, at a very tender age, began to breathe the fire of revolution, into his soul. Not a revolution of the careless and suicidal kind espoused by many black groups during the 1960s, but a revolution of the spirit and of the morals and of the mental habits of the masses of Negroes that had been reduced to mere property of ruthless slave masters for over 2.5 dark and desolate centuries on the shores and on the plantations and on the bayous of Southern America. And up from slavery, his book, his autobiography, Booker T. Washington recalled, "I had no schooling whatever. I had no schooling whatever while I was a slave, though I remember on several occasions I went as far as the schoolhouse door with one of my young mistresses to carry her books." And one can imagine this mistress, whose name was Miss Laura Burroughs, by the way, one can imagine her looking at her young helper, her young Negro helper, who longed to go into the classroom and learn. But she said, "If you want to imagine it, no, Booker, I can't let you go inside. Learning is not for niggers." A crushing thing to tell a young child with a bright mind that wants to learn. "I can't let you go inside. Learning is not for niggers." The picture of several dozen little white boys and girls in a schoolroom, says Booker T. Washington, engaged in study, made a deep impression upon me, and I had the feeling that to get into a schoolhouse and study in this way would be about the same as getting into paradise. I had the feeling that to get into a schoolhouse and study the way that he saw these little white boys and girls engaged in study would be about the same for him as getting into paradise. Well, decades later, when the masses of African Americans were permitted and even encouraged to become educated, Dr. Washington, in The Future of the American Negro, another book which he published that he wrote, he promoted the idea that we have spent much time in the South in educating men and women, in letters alone, meaning the literary arts, reading and writing and arithmetic and the study of the classics, etc. And now we must turn our attention more than ever to educating them to supply their wants and needs. Indeed, this alone was a revolutionary concept because for nearly 3 centuries, the African Americans in the South had been forced to be completely dependent upon their slave masters and their slave masters' children to supply all of their wants and needs. Black revolutionary author Professor Larry Neal noted that the Black Power movement, a central that he expected to be the Black revolutionary that God had sent them. Little did he expect to be the Black revolutionary that God had sent them to completely change their lives. reflecting on his life's work in his book, Up From Slavery. Booker T. Washington very soberly and candidly confesses, quote, what I saw during my month of travel and investigation upon his arrival in Tuskegee, Alabama, left me with a very heavy heart. The work to be done in order to lift these people up seemed almost beyond accomplishing. Of one thing, I felt more strongly convinced than ever after spending this month in seeing the actual life of the colored people, and that was that in order to lift them up, something must be done more than merely to imitate New England education as it then existed, unquote. It is interesting to note at this point that here is a young man quite new to the dangers inherent in being a black man in the hostile Deep South, who has one single focus in his mind, and that is to revolutionize and to change completely the impoverished and degraded lives of his fellow African Americans. Unlike later black revolutionaries who sought to bring about these changes through political agitation or even threats of mob violence, as in the Watts riots that occurred 50 years after his death in 1965, Booker T. Washington was determined to use industriousness, education, and community development or nation building as the vehicle to lift the ex-slaves up as human beings and citizens of the United States of America. As stated, however, the type of education that he proposed was not the kind that was used to educate the already settled European Americans. Dr. Washington knew that teaching sharecroppers and tenant farmers how to read and write Greek and Latin or recite the romantic poetry of Wordsworth or Keats or Byron and Shelley was not the most advantageous road to economic and cultural advancement for the newly emancipated slaves. Another black revolutionary, Professor W.E.B. Du Bois, a product of a New England Harvard education, opposed Booker T. Washington's method of uplifting the recently emancipated African Americans who lived in the Deep South. Although he had lived in urban Nashville, Tennessee, and Atlanta, Georgia, Dr. Du Bois's appreciation for the day-to-day struggles of black and brown people lacked the depth of understanding that growing up on a Virginia slave plantation had given Booker T. Washington early in his life. He lacked the appreciation and the understanding that growing up on a Virginia slave plantation had given Booker T. Washington early in his life. Dr. Du Bois admitted that the prudent method of bringing about the cooperation of the European Americans in the uplifting of African Americans, the prudent method was to weld the former slaves to the future industries of the South. Although he praised the accomplishments of the common schools and the trade schools, such as the Tuskegee Institute, headed by Booker T. Washington, Professor Du Bois believed that it was the classical college education that would be the best vehicle to advance the masses of African Americans through the agency of the Talented Tenth, which was a few specially selected college-trained African Americans, which he dubbed the Talented Tenth. Du Bois's thinking was that within the minds of African Americans, there must come a loftier respect for the human soul that seeks to know itself and the world around it, and that seeks a freedom for self-expression and self-development. In achieving this ambitious goal of lifting up our people intellectually and culturally, W.E.B. Du Bois called upon classical intellectuals such as Shakespeare, Balzac, Dumas, Aristotle, and Aurelius as beacons for African-American enlightenment. I'll stop the reading right now. See, we've had several or a couple of others come online, and I just want to introduce again our topic for this evening. We don't have but about 20 minutes left. Our topic for this evening is how can we improve African-American education, and I just want to provide a segue into that discussion. I was spending the earlier part of the hour previewing my new book, Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution, the special edition, which is in publication at this time and should be available for purchase in about 1 month. But it was originally published in November of 2015 and is now being revised. But I just want to share something from Professor John Harris that was written a number of years ago, but it's still relevant. Dr. Harris says, concerning education as it has proceeded since integration occurred back in the 50s, which actually didn't really take off until the late 60s and early 70s, even though the law was changed so that it could be accomplished in the late 50s. But the Supreme Court said that the states could proceed basically as slow as they wanted to go. But Dr. Harris said it was the black masses who first perceived that integration actually increases the white community's control over the black one by destroying black institutions, absorbing black leadership, and making its interests coincide with those of the white community. The international brain drain has its counterpart in the black community, which is constantly being denuded of its best trained people and many of its national leaders. Black institutions of all sorts, colleges, newspapers, banks, and even community organizations are all losing their better people to the newly available openings of white establishments. This lowers the quality of the Negro organizations, and in some cases causes their demise and or increases their dependence on whites for survival. Such injurious, if unintended, side effects of integration have been felt in almost every layer of the black community. I'm going to go ahead now, and the mic is open at this time for our visitors. And if any one of you would like to take up that particular thought, that integration has actually been a disservice in many ways in the schools towards our children's development and in producing leaders for our community, you may go right ahead. First one that speaks will have the floor for the time that you need, and then we'll go ahead and share it with the next person.
Okay. Good evening. Can you hear me?
I can hear you fine. Can you hear me?
Okay, yes. Okay. My name is Maina Hamid. I'm in Augusta, Georgia. And I'm sorry to get on so late. I was trying to find the number. I just found it. You said your topic was how can we improve African-American education?
Yes, that's the topic for this evening.
Okay. We had a discussion last night, and I couldn't get back on for whatever you couldn't hear me, but we're dealing with the oligarchy, which is not even an oligarchy anymore. It's a plutocracy now. These people have been playing their little games with not only African Americans but just poor people in general by dividing and conquering us, using inventing race. Race is something that they use to make white people feel that they were superior to anybody that wasn't white. And by virtue of their skin color, they manipulate poor whites. And same thing just happened with Donald Trump election. They're still the oligarchy and the plutocracy. They manipulate the poor whites into believing that any kind of gains that black people have made was because of it came at a cost, was at their expense. And now they're moving it up to another phase. They're going to use the immigrants now are going to be the immigrants and the blacks and the Muslims. So they're just playing games. Nothing has changed in this country where I can see since 1600s, 1700s. Nothing has changed. So as far as educating our children, we first have to get some kind of economic roots going. We have to make progress in our community economically in order to, we have to get our people to understand that, okay, we just had a black president, but still, what happened? We're still in the same place. We have no roots. Martin Luther King's sculpture up there has no feet. No back either, I don't think. All over this planet, we have black people in the same condition. We have no convention centers. We can't compare to any other ethnic groups as far as making progress in our community. There's so much, it's like Jomo Kenyatta said, when the missionaries came to Africa, they came with the Bible. They taught them how to pray with their eyes closed. And when they opened their eyes, the missionaries had the land and they had the Bible. And I don't see where anything has changed. And until we get some kind of economic footing so that we can have a civilized, intelligent, thriving, and productive community, I don't see where we're going to be able to move forward in terms of educating our people, because they have us in a catch-22. If you teach in a school system, you know that the parents have to help their children at home. If the parents don't help the children at home, then how are the children going to learn when they come to school? The teacher can't teach all social skills, academics, and whatever. It's just not going to work. So people are overwhelmed in the school system right now. It's like the art of war is going on. You're trying to avoid conflict, and avoiding conflict is costly because the winner of the comparison is always going to get certain rewards, and competition is going to always be a comparison, and both are inevitable. And the comparison must be made before the choices can be made. And so you got parents at home trying to go to work, trying to take care of the kids. They can't come to the after school programs. They help their kids. The kids can't come to the after school program. I mean, it's just crazy. Until we get this economic, community economic thing set up and work together and struggle to make the sacrifice, like other companies, other people come to this country, and they're not trying to get into the White House, but what they are doing is they're making themselves a part of that tax base, the people who are being taxed, so that they can have a voice my thing is, I see that we have to make progress as a community economically before we can move forward.
Well, thank you. I hope that this will lead into an even more in-depth discussion about how we can change our economic situation. The mic is still open, and we invite anyone else who would like to
We have about 11 minutes left. We would like to make comments to go right ahead and take advantage of this time we have remaining.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead, please.
Oh, hi. This is Paulette Horton from Mobile, Alabama. How you doing?
Oh, just fine, Paulette. Good to hear from you.
Good. Okay. My thing is, you know, Booker T. Washington said we should always start from the bottom and work our way up. And in order to understand what we could do for education, you have to first appreciate where you live. Many people are not comfortable, you know, with where they live. I went into a neighborhood once. There was trash blowing everywhere, chicken bones, and, you know, when you trash your neighborhood and you see trash on the campus, that shows that you don't appreciate where you are. And I think that in order to appreciate education, you got to appreciate your living situation, and you got to take pride in your community and just take a stand in what you believe is comfortable for you. Because one thing, Booker T. Washington, they hated to see him coming back from his travels, because he always inspected everything. He inspected the campus. He inspected the furniture. He inspected everything to make sure everything is kept up. And in our neighborhoods, we should not have trash blowing everywhere, people cussing in front of your elders. It's those little things that you have to work on, because that is part of education. When you learn to respect yourself, you learn to respect. If you can respect yourself, you can respect your elders. And I just believe that, and that goes to, if you can respect yourself, you can respect the teachers that's before you trying to teach you. So we got to begin on a smaller level and work our way up. And that's what I believe. Until for you to grow, you have to understand the little things first. You can't have the big thing until you can fix the little things.
Can I ask you?